Oh man, I tell you what if we didn't have to depend on an app or, you know, artificial intelligence to, as they just said right there, protect us from ourselves? I mean, think about that for a moment. In fact, here's perhaps a better question that maybe some of you have considered over the course of your adult life. Why are people who have had too much to drink inclined to make such bad decisions? You ever wondered that? Maybe you've probably heard stories, perhaps you have stories, or maybe even some of your stories are a bit fuzzy right now. You know, what's the correlation between overconsumption of alcohol and making bad decisions? Because as far as I know, at least, you know, to my awareness, I don't think it's connected with making good decisions. I've never heard anybody say, man, I was so glad I was drunk because that helped me make some really, really good decisions. And so, you know, I think a friend of mine even put it one time. He said, you know, Kurt, everybody I've connected with over the course of my life that I've talked to that's had some kind of violation in their marriage, an affair, some kind of infidelity somewhere along the way in that story was overconsumption of alcohol. And so, kind of back to the question, why are people who have had too much to drink inclined to make such bad decisions? Well, you know, physiologically, I mean, there's a couple reasons. In fact, you know, you probably know these, but alcohol actually increases norepinephrine in our brain, and norepinephrine is a stimulant, and so that kind of increases our impulsiveness, and it takes away our inhibitions, and so it causes us to not really understand or think about the potential consequences of our decisions. And then, you know, another reason, maybe worse even, is alcohol temporarily impairs the kind of prefrontal cortex of our brain. This is part of our brain that helps us understand that what I do today actually, you know, plays into my tomorrow and the day after that. And this is the part of the brain that, like, isn't even developed until you're, like, into your 20s, like 22, 23, and for some of us much later in life than that. And so, you know, it's a good question, you know, because alcohol is a way of kind of causing us to not think clearly and to not feel appropriately. And it causes us to be more brave, you know, than cautious. And at times it causes us to be loud when we, you know, maybe should be quiet. In fact, comedian Ron White, he actually, one time after he had been arrested for public intoxication, he said, "While I had the right to remain silent, I did not have the ability to." And so, you know, this is why people who've had too much to drink oftentimes are inclined to make really bad decisions. And that's why the next day we end up texting our friends and we're like, "Did I really say that? You know, are you sure it was me? Oh, there's video." Okay. And so, you know, we just begin to realize that okay, maybe that's not the best decision-making place. Now you might be thinking, okay, what does this have to do with you? Well, if you've ever found yourself at the end of one of these conversations, you probably know exactly what this has to do with you. And if you haven't, if you don't drink or you're sober, you know, I'm not making an advocate for drinking or not. I am making an advocate for drinking too much, against drinking too much. But, you know, you might be thinking, oh, I'm clear on this. Well, we're going to kind of circle around back to this here in a bit and connect what this has to do with you. So, man, we're glad you're here this weekend. My name's Kurt, and it's great to have you join us. If you're here for the first time, we certainly hope it's not your last time. Those of you tuning in online, it's great to have you join us from wherever you're joining us from this weekend. And, you know, we've been tracking on this big idea over the last few weeks of this overlooked relationship between good decisions and good questions. In fact, we really think that good decisions start with good questions, and kind of bad decisions oftentimes are because we're not asking the right questions. And so we're just convinced that if you will ask and then answer honestly, and then based on your honest answer, you'll then go and act based on that. As we look at these five questions over the course of this series, we just think you're going to make better decisions. And ultimately, you're going to be better at life, and that's one of our goals here, is to help you be better at life. And when that happens, life is better. We believe when we follow God's ways and the things Jesus gives us, we're actually better at life. And again, life is so much better. So we've been challenging you each week to memorize this proverb, and here's what the proverb says. It says, "The prudent see danger," meaning they recognize it, they pay attention to it, and they take refuge. They adjust, they do something different. But the simple or the naive, or those who don't understand that today is actually connected to tomorrow and the next day, they just kind of put their head in the sand. They don't pay attention to things going on around them, and they keep going, and ultimately they end up paying the penalty. And so the reason we're encouraging you to memorize this verse is because, you know, these five questions we're talking about over the course of this series, they're simple questions, but this verse causes us to slow down. This verse causes us to kind of, you know, maybe consider the ultimate, not just the immediate decisions and the options right in front of me. And ultimately, you know, it helps me see the potential danger and to connect the dots on how this and the decisions connected to this actually play into tomorrow. Now, if you've been tracking along on our questions each week, week one, we looked at the integrity question, which is this question, am I being honest with myself? And then we added the word really to the end of it. Am I being honest with myself? Really? All right, because sometimes we lie to ourselves a lot in terms of reality. And so I hope that question's been helpful and you've been able to begin to, you know, experience some benefits from that question. And then last week, we looked at the legacy question, which is the question, what story do I want to tell? And when you think about this, I mean, the decision you're in the midst of right now, whatever decision that is, whether it's relational, financial, maybe something academic, something with, you know, with your career, whatever it might be, eventually that decision is just going to be a 2 or 3 sentence paragraph that's just part of the story of your life. And so, you know, this question, what story do I want to tell down the road when I'm looking back? Or what story do I want to tell to my kids or my grandkids? That's a really good question. Now, this third question that we're going to look at today is called the conscience question. And this also brings us back to kind of where I started with this whole idea of inebriated people, all right? Because see, here's the thing. While intoxicated people, they actually can't necessarily pay attention to the external and the internal cues. I mean, alcohol is a way of kind of numbing that inside of us. Sober folks, on the other hand, are guilty of ignoring the internal cues and the external cues. And so, you know, intoxicated people kind of silence their conscience, where, you know, sober people just kind of ignore their conscience. And when I say conscience, I mean, you know, that voice inside your head that kind of creates this tension, you know, that competes for your attention. And so, you know, intoxicated people, they can't help themselves, but, you know, sober people actually just choose not to help themselves. But it's crazy because the result at the end of the day is oftentimes eerily similar, and the outcomes are oftentimes very much the same. And so the conscience question is really a good question. So we're going to dive into this week, and here's the question. The question is there a tension in my life right now, things I'm going through, deciding on, is there a tension that deserves my attention? Meaning, as you make decisions, as you think about the options that are in front of you, as you think and begin to hone in on one option, is there an option that I'm looking at that's really creating a tension inside of me? Because probably more times than we're willing to admit, as we consider options and the decisions that we make, we begin to feel a tension, an internal tension. It's something that causes us to hesitate, something that gives us a reason to pause. And we're not even sure why. But it's almost like the warning light on your dashboard that comes on, right? I mean, when that light on your dash comes on, now if it's flashing, that usually means stop. Like right now, pull over. That means something is radically wrong. You're going to blow your car up, so you need to immediately stop as quick as you can. But if that light just comes on and stays lit, usually that means, hey, there's something in the systems, one of the systems in your car, that's just not quite right. We can't put a finger on it, but this is something you need to pay attention to. And so the light comes on as kind of a reminder to draw our attention to, hey, there's something going on that you need to give some attention to. Now, you may have another name for it, but you know, honestly, it's really that, like, what's going on? What's causing you in our decision-making when we consider an option that we just go, oh man, that just doesn't seem quite right there. And when that happens, here's what you do. We owe it to ourselves to actually pause and to actually pay attention to the tension, to not ignore it, to not just rush by it, to not just, you know, brush by it or push by it, or to kind of talk ourselves past it as we so often like to do. But we need to actually let it bother us. And that is very, very hard to do. And so, you know, this is kind of the case for all the reasons we already talked about in this series. Like last week, we looked at focalism and how focalism has this ability to kind of, you know, blur and distort things. And then, you know, confirmation bias causes us to not exactly see things the way that they are, but the way we want to see them. And then our schedule and our urgency has a way of like compressing things. And we feel this urgency to make a decision now. And as we've talked about, there's this like salesman in our voice in our head that kind of has a voice very similar to ours that's like, hey, you need to move on this, you need to move now, you're going to lose it. But when there's something inside of you that feels like, oh man, I'm not quite sure why, but something doesn't seem right about this, when something dings your conscience, this is a moment where you need to just pause and pay attention. And then there's this, and we've probably all experienced this at some point or another. But, you know, maybe we're considering an option. We're making a big decision. Something that's going to impact some element of our life. And everything seems to be coming together. And we don't have any reason to pause. We're like, yeah, things are just kind of, I'm feeling good about where they are. But somebody else comes in and raises a tension for us, says, hey, what about this? And maybe because they raise that, then all of a sudden we feel a bit of hesitation. And before there wasn't hesitation, but now there is hesitation. And so you've been given reason to just kind of like think twice about this. And in our younger years, usually that was like a mom or a dad, right? Moms and dads are really good at this. You know, where we're like, hey, honey, like that all sounds great. Only thing is it's, I think it's illegal. Just small detail. Like I had that conversation with one of my kids recently. Not sure. I mean, I get it. It sounds fun, but I think it might be illegal. And as we get older, then it kind of turns to our friends and maybe confidants. And, you know, they might say to us, well, that all sounds good and it makes sense. And I get your thinking. And I totally understand. But like, what does your wife think about this? Or what does your husband think about this? Or does your boss know that you're doing this? And see, the problem when we as friends bring things front and center is then it creates relational tension. But see, we got to pay attention to that tension as well, because here's the reason. Because we all, and I'm including myself in this, because I have a tendency to do this as well, we all have a tendency to dodge the truth by discounting the truth teller, right? And we begin to go, oh, he doesn't know. She's never done this before. He doesn't lead a business. They've never started something. They don't have any kids. What do they know about parenting? Look at their life. Their life's a mess. What am I going to learn from them? So we discount. And see, there's actually a term for this. Experts actually call this genetic fallacy or the fallacy of origin, where we actually discount the source of something because we don't like the source, or we don't feel like it's valid. So we ignore it. And so as you think about your options, you think about decisions that you're gonna make this week, you know, whatever those might be, if you get to a place and you feel a bit of tension, you know, and something bothers you, let whatever's bothering you bother you. All right? If there's something about him as you're dating him, and it's like, oh, that just bothers me, let it bother you. Like, let that play out a bit. Like, you know, just pause on that for a moment. If there's something about a job offer, a contract that bothers you, like, let it bother you. If there's something about moving forward, you're like, yeah, this doesn't quite seem right, let it bother you. Pay attention to the tension until either the tension resolves or until you begin to see that there might be another option. Now, we're going to look at a story this weekend that, again, I love these stories from the Old Testament. These stories are really cool because we see individuals, and even though their lives are very different than us, we see how God interacts with them and how they interact with God in working through issues and trusting and God helping them trust in the process of living life. And so this story is a story about a guy by the name of King David, who you may have heard of before, and it really illustrates the importance of paying attention. All right, especially when it causes a little bit of inconvenience in our life. So if you're not familiar with King David, he kind of steps on the pages of history as a shepherd boy. One day, a prophet shows up at his house and says to his parents, hey, mom and dad, we believe, in fact, we've anointed your son, David, the next king of the Israelites. Now, I'm telling you something. When a prophet shows up at your house and says, hey, your son's going to be the next king, that's a good day, right? Like, that's a day when you celebrate. Like, wow, okay, we should be proud of ourselves right here. And so the problem, though, was there was already a king in Israel. His name was Saul. The other problem was Saul wasn't a very good king. And so God was kind of replacing him as king, but not yet. And so as time goes by, David eventually has this big iconic moment, which you probably heard of if you're not familiar with David, where he kind of, you know, beats this giant named Goliath. You probably heard the story of David and Goliath. And so immediately after that event, David's notorious. I mean, his popularity is going up, up, up. And of course, just like you and I would probably feel if you saw somebody that was called your predecessor and his popularity or her popularity is beginning to climb and people like him and celebrate him more than you, you would probably get jealous. And so that's what happens with Saul. And so Saul's like, hey, I'm going to take David out. I'm going to kill David. So David finds out about this and he flees. He goes on the run. And so now he's a fugitive on the run, running from the king. And yet the people of Israel, they see David as a war hero. They remember what he did with the Philistines. They're like, man, he's a hero to us. And so at one point, David was in Saul's army, but now he's on the run. But people still see him as this leader. And so dozens and dozens of kind of, you know, rough and tumble men begin to gravitate to David and kind of make this little army that he begins to form, kind of known as David's Merry Men, just a kind of guys like David, fugitives, people that are running. And so, you know, they don't have a home. They're an army without a home. And they're made up of people like him, people who are kind of out running, fugitives of the law. And so Saul and his army, they follow David into this desert, the desert of En-Gedi. And basically in following him, they're like, hey, we got him out here. This is kind of our chance to take care of him once and for all. Because see, Saul wants his son, Jonathan, to be the next king, even though we hear David was anointed the next king. And so, as the story goes, Saul gets some pretty good intel on David's out in, you know, the desert of En-Gedi. And so Saul's like, hey, this is our opportunity. We're going to go out. We're going to take care of David once and for all. And so here's where we pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 24. And so it says, so Saul took 3,000 able young men. Think about that. 3,000 soldiers. That is a lot of soldiers. You know, to gather 100 soldiers at that time was incredible. But to get all of that number, 3,000 in one place, I don't know how he did that. But he did. Saul took 3,000 young able men from Israel and set out to look for David and his men. You may go, and why did he take so many men to conquer one guy? Well, because he knew of the story of David and the Philistine. He knew of David's military acumen. And so late one afternoon, they're going through this valley, this kind of windswept part of the desert. And it says that he, meaning Saul, came to the sheep pen along the way. A cave was there. Saul saw the cave. He went up to relieve himself. Now, I think this is like the only reference to going in to the bathroom in the Bible, just so you know. And if you have like junior high boys in your house, like, and you're like, what would keep their attention? I think you just found your story. All right? And so, I don't know why this detail is in there, but it is. And this is where the story takes a weird and kind of strange and unique twist of fate. And so David and this handful of merry men, his ragtag army, get this, it's so amazing. They're actually hiding in the back of the cave that Saul goes up to relieve himself in, the cave he chooses. How crazy is that? Absolutely amazing. It's like the stars are aligning right here. How much more perfect could this get? And so this is like the best case scenario for David right here. All right, because David has intel as well. In fact, he heard Saul and his large army were kind of coming through the area. So he said to his men, hey, guys, go up into the caves, up into the hills, hide, kind of scatter and hide so that Saul will pass through, not see us. And when he's gone, we'll come out and go the other way. And all of this is working perfectly until Saul has to use the can. All right, and so Saul dismounts off his mule. He's riding a mule at the time. And he goes into the very cave, of all caves he could have chose, he goes into the very cave that David is actually made as his temporary hideout. And he goes in there to sit on the throne. So, I mean, what are the odds of this? Just think about this for a moment. How did this actually all line up? And imagine this from David's perspective for just a moment. I mean, he's inside the cave. He sees Saul coming up the hill toward him. He's like, oh my gosh, he's coming toward me. So he moves further back into the recesses of the cave. Before long, he sees Saul standing right there in the mouth of the cave, and Saul appears as a silhouette with the light behind him. And all David sees is a silhouette of his body. And Saul has just come in from the Middle Eastern sun, so like he can't see anything. I mean, he's in the darkness of the cave. And he walks in just far enough to ensure privacy. And then he takes off his cloak, he throws it aside, and he hikes up his outer garment, and he squats down at the opening of the cave with his back to David to do his business. Think about this. I mean, clearly for David, this is like an omen, right? I mean, it's like, how much more perfectly could things align? Where's the Powerball, right? Like, give me a ticket, I'm in. I mean, what's the possibility of this? And what does this mean? Because here sits, in the opening of a cave, the current king, vulnerable, caught in a moment where he's unsuspecting and his pants are on the ground. And so, if David isn't thinking this, his men are. Because see, the biographer who's there telling us the story, he says that the men whispered to David, David, this is the day the Lord spoke about. When he said to you a long time ago, I'm going to give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. And there he is right in front of him. I mean, his men are probably like, are you kidding me? How did this happen? And this is what we've waited for. God must have orchestrated this very moment right here. I mean, you can imagine the emotion in the cave, right? You can imagine the adrenaline that David must be feeling as a warrior in that moment. But see, what makes this story more interesting is David begins to feel something else. He begins to feel a bit of hesitation. He begins to feel a sense of, I'm not exactly sure what's going on right here. I got a little bit of tension right here. He wasn't even sure why he was feeling that way, and he didn't know how to make any sense of it. And so, probably like you and I would have done, he begins to act. All right, he draws his dagger and he's standing right before Saul. Saul has no idea he's standing there because he can't see. His eyes haven't adjusted. And he has every intention to reach around him and just slit his throat. And if David's successful, I mean, the world as they know it, and these men know, and his men know, it changes immediately, and they walk out of that cave, free men. Nobody's chasing them, trying to take their lives from them anymore. And so David, he gets a little bit closer and a little bit closer, and as he gets closer, that tension begins to build. And David does something that, you know, I don't know why he does this, there's really no other alternative out of the cave. It's like not like he has a lot of other options, but David pays attention to this tension. He pays attention to what's bothering him. He lets what's bothering him bother him. And somewhere between the back of the cave, as he's creeping up in the back of Saul's neck, all of a sudden, as he's just seconds away from acting, in that moment, he gains a sense of clarity. And all of a sudden, he goes, oh my gosh, I'm about to kill a king. I mean, this isn't war. We're not in combat right here. I mean, this is going to be like cold-blooded murder. I mean, this can't be right. And besides, I mean, who put Saul in place anyway? I mean, God put him on the throne. I mean, who am I to remove who God put in place? Even if this guy's trying to kill me. And so, I mean, it's just amazing. And in spite of the pressure to act in that moment, the pressure that his men behind him probably were like, David, what are you doing? Why are you not moving? David, in that moment, he changes course. Now, this is the part of the story which is so fascinating, because this is, I think, where you can relate and I can relate into the story. David didn't know the outcome of what was going to happen with Saul. All right, think about it. He didn't know. I mean, he'd been told he was going to be king a number of years ago. He'd been told, hey, you're anointed as the next king, but it hadn't happened yet. Maybe God had taken his hand off him. Maybe things had changed. Maybe it just didn't pan out the way that they'd become. But he knew that if I kill the king, I will become king. I mean, come on, why am I hesitating? Why am I pushing pause here for a moment? See, one of the reasons, this is so important right here in this story, one of the reasons we ignore the tension when we're making a decision, that we sometimes just push right through that tension, that we feel right through, that we just ignore, you know, that sense of, oh, this doesn't seem right, is because I believe in many cases we believe we can predict the future. We think we can predict the outcome. We can control the outcome. All right, and so we make decisions thinking, well, here's the outcome, and we make decisions that later on we come to regret, because you can't accurately predict the future, can you? I can't accurately predict the future. None of us can. In fact, just to illustrate, let me ask you this. Have you ever been disappointed? Think about that. I mean, what's disappointment? Disappointment is when we mispredict the future, right? When we have a certain expectation that doesn't come about. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from a leader that I know is a guy by the name of John Pistol. He's the president of Anderson University just up the road. And he used to be the head of TSA, in airports across the country. And he has this saying. He says, leadership is disappointing people at a pace that they can handle. And I love that, because why is that so true? It's because we have certain expectations. We think we can predict the future, and people think leaders can predict the future, but we can't. And so we get disappointed because it doesn't have the outcome that we want. See, the point is, ignoring the tension sets you up for disappointment. Ignoring the tension, you know, paying attention to the tension, if there's something bothering me, let it bother me. This is how you avoid unnecessary disappointment. And so David, he's inches away from reaching around and slitting Saul's throat, and he realizes, hey, just because I kill the king doesn't mean I'm going to be made king. I mean, the one thing is certain, if I kill the king, then I'm going to be the one who killed the king. I'm going to be a murderer. That's going to be my legacy. That's going to be my story. That's the story people are going to tell about me. And so, I mean, just imagine this for a moment. Imagine his grandkids one day, Grandpa, can you tell us again how you became, you know, the king of the nation of Israel? I mean, you remember like how you were there in the cave and Saul was sitting, you know, doing his business in front of you, and his hands were down and he was preoccupied and you just reached around and slit his throat. I mean, Grandpa, you were so brave. I don't think that's the story that David wants to be told about him. In fact, the author, the biographer of the story, actually says that David was conscience stricken because he was paying attention. And so, in his paying attention and being bothered by the tension, he does something that not many people have the ability to do. He exhibits self-control, and he actually changed his course. And so instead of murdering Saul, he cuts off a corner of Saul's robe that's sitting on the rock next to him. And he makes his way back to the back of the cave. And of course, his guys that are back there, you know, waiting, they're probably like, David, what are you doing? We're so close to going home. But David turns and he whispers to his men, he says, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing. They're like, yeah, but David, isn't that why we're here? He says, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master and the Lord's anointed. To which they're like, David, if you don't want to do it, man, I'll step up and do it. I mean, if you don't want to do what we're here to do, then let me at him. I'll take care of Saul for you. And David says, no. In fact, it says with these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and he went his merry way, having no idea how close he was in that moment to losing his life. Now, the next part of the story, again, every turn is just so amazing. Think about this. Saul's army is still down in the valley. They've been waiting for him. Saul, he puts his robe on. He exits the cave. He's got 3,000 men down in this valley waiting for him. And you know, he's been spending his time up there sitting on his proverbial throne, right? And you know, the Daily Mail says the average guy spends 14 minutes a day in the bathroom. So, you know, I don't know, probably 7, 8 minutes, 9 minutes. He probably had a couple stops during the day. And so, you know, he spent 7 or 8 minutes up there. He comes walking down. He gets on his donkey, because he would have been on a donkey, and they begin to go away, and as soon as they begin to head out, he hears someone yell his name, Saul, Saul! And all 3,000 heads turn and look over their shoulder. And guess who appears out of the mouth of the cave? I mean, the very man that they were hunting, the giant killer, right out of the mouth of the cave that Saul just walked out of, that Saul just exited. I mean, imagine the drama of this. And he's holding something. He says, Saul, woohoo. He just dangles the corner of his robe. Saul immediately turns back. He looks, and sure enough, his robe has been cut. And then David, he kneels down, face to the ground. And he just stays there at the mouth of the cave. And all 3,000 men in that moment, everyone knows, including Saul, they recognize David as the better man right here. And see, once again, David becomes the hero in his story because he spared Saul's life. And everybody knew Saul would not have done that for David. And then David closes with a short little speech. And this is something we should really pay attention to. Everybody in that moment, all 3,000 people standing in that valley, they all heard David say this. He said, may the Lord judge between you, Saul, and between me. Meaning, may the Lord be our judge. I'm going to wait. I'm not going to take this into my hands. All right, I'm gonna wait. I'm gonna let you tell me when it's time. I'm not gonna let your bad behavior, Saul, cause me to do things that I know I shouldn't be doing. I don't want to be like you, Saul. And all eyes are on Saul, right? Because he's humiliated in this moment. And I mean, David is an amazing thing. He humiliated King Saul, not with his military prowess, but with his humility. And so, what are you gonna do if you're Saul now? Like, what does Saul do? Does he just keep chasing him? Does he like put his hands over his face and be like, hey, I'm gonna give you to 20. I'm gonna count, then I'm gonna come after you, you know, get a head start. No, I mean, Saul knows better. Let me ask you a question. Do you want to be the hero in your story? See, you and I, we have the decision to make that we, every single day, we can be the hero in our story. Do you want to be the hero in your own story? I mean, this is what we talked about last weekend. Do you want to write a story you'll be proud of? Do you want to write a story that one day your kids and your grandkids will be like, oh my gosh, I'm so proud of, you know, my parents' story. If so, man, pay attention. Pay attention. See, months later, Saul and his army, they're again fighting the Philistines. I mean, they're entangled in this battle with the Philistines once again. And there was this random Philistine archer who shoots this random Philistine arrow over the front lines of the Israelites to the back lines. And this random arrow from this random archer makes its way back to the back line, and it just finds this random seam in Saul's armor and pierces him. And Saul knows he's about to die, and he doesn't want to be known as being killed by the Philistines, so he actually falls on his sword, and he dies. And the Philistines rout the Israelites. And when word gets back to the city, the big Israelite city, that King Saul's dead, everybody declares that David is now king. And he became king without murdering a king. Now, I don't know what David was thinking. This isn't in the text. This is all conjecture right here. But I have to think he was going, geez, tell you what, if somebody would have told me how this story was going to play out, I mean, that cave episode would have been a lot easier if I would have known, like, the, you know, seven chapters later, I mean, the Philistines are going to take care of Saul. But listen, you and I both know this isn't how life works, right? This is why we have to pay attention. We have to pay attention to those internal tensions. We have to resist taking matters into our own hands. We have to, you know, not trust that we know the outcomes, or we can shape the outcomes, right? That's why every decision we make of any magnitude, I mean, this is a question I think it's worth asking. Is there a tension as I'm thinking about my options or honing in on one option? Is there a tension that deserves my attention? I think it's a good question. In fact, I was with a few pastors about a month ago, some guys that I know, and we hadn't been together for a while, and so we were connecting, hanging out, encouraging one another, hearing each other's stories. Really good, just cool to spend some time with some other pastors. And there's one guy who used to kind of connect with us, and then he'd been out of that circle for a while because he left his position, and then he'd just come back and started a new startup about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And it was in the very kind of a very organic startup, and I was really encouraged by his story. Because he was talking about how he kind of got his team together, and they were kind of small, and they were trying to figure out, okay, what's our next steps? And they wanted to identify a place to meet. And so they were contacting local places, couldn't find a place. They finally found a business that they could meet in on weekends. And I remember the tensions of that. I mean, when we started across the street, we met at Fall Creek Intermediate School, and just when we found out that school was available, we're like, oh man, we got to nail this down. We need to do it quickly before somebody else comes and, you know, the schedule, you know, gets interrupted and so on. And so I just remember all the anxiety and tension around that. And so he was talking about how the day that he was to show up and sign the document in March of 2020, he said, there's just something inside of me that just caused me to hesitate and go, gosh, I don't. There's something about this that doesn't feel good. And he couldn't put his finger on it. He said, the only thing I could decide was, I think it had to do with the fact that they wanted to charge us even if we weren't going to be there for a week. So like if we took a week off or, you know, whatever, we still had to pay rent regardless of whether we were there or not. And he said, I just woke up that morning on March 12th, 2020, and I decided, you know, I need to pause. I can't go through with this. I don't know why. I can't figure out the tension. So he showed up at the meeting and said, you know, I'm sorry. Thanks for working with us and, you know, appreciate it, but I'm not going to be able to sign this contract. He said literally like 4 or 5 hours later, he, just like I and others in our community, got a message from our mayor, and our governor went on the air, and president of our country went on and said, hey, this COVID is like taking over. We need to begin to isolate. And, you know, the whole season we've been going through began on that day. And he said, man, I don't know why I had that hesitation other than if we would have signed that paperwork, it probably would have sunk us. Because we, you know, churches didn't meet in person for a few months, at least sometimes a year. And he said, I just had this uneasy feeling. He paid attention to the tension. And now they're up and going and trying to navigate. How do they continue to grow and connect with people? And you might be thinking, okay, Kurt, well, what does all of that have to do with me? Well, here's what I know about you. Whatever decision you're in right now, it's probably somewhere between signing on a paper and murdering a king. But the principles with everything in between are the same. And if you feel something, you're like, man, I just can't put my finger on this. There's something that's bothering me. I'm just a bit unsettled. Man, stop. Pay attention to that. Let that bother you. Give it some time. You know, give it enough time until you know why the tension is there. You know, give it enough time until you see that perhaps there's other options. I mean, this may be God's way of protecting you or protecting your family or causing you to not make a decision that, you know, even hours later you will regret. I mean, there's a power that comes when we pay attention. And sometimes even new pathways may not be ready, but eventually are revealed in their time. And so here's the question again. I just want you to think about this week. I think it's such a powerful question. Is there a tension, as you think about decisions you're making this week, is there a tension that deserves my attention? And as you consider your options this week, man, I just encourage you to lean into this question. And pay attention. Pay attention to that tension. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to be so glad. So glad that you did. And this is where we're going to pick up next week with question 4. Let's go ahead and stand. I want to pray for us. And I want to invite God's Spirit to intervene with whatever decisions we are in the midst of right now. Let's do that. God, thank you for man, this amazing story of David, for the ways in which you showed up. He had no idea how this was going to pan out. as we think about the decisions we're in the midst of right now, we have no idea. We have no idea. We probably are more aware right now that we have very little control of the future. And God, there's a great opportunity for us to lean in and trust you, and for us to lean in to understand what it means to discern and to pay attention to the tension and to trust you in the midst of that. And so I just pray, God, that with whatever decision each and every one of us, with every single person that's been earshot of my voice right now, as we think about our options this week, God, help us to pay attention. Help us to be bothered, if you will, until something resolves or till new opportunities come. We just pray, God, that your spirit would be very alive, and we would be very aware of how you're moving and how you're guiding us. And we thank you, God, for being that kind of God. And we pray these things in your name, Jesus.